powered lights along the cloister. But when he stretched out his hand and pressed down the switch, they came on, and he could see that the stone floor was thick with leaves. Even as he closed the door behind him, another gust shook the great tree and sent the drift of leaves around its trunk bowling and scurrying about his feet. They swirled about him like a flock of brown birds, pecked gently against his cheek, and lay weightless as feathers on the shoulders of his cloak. He scrunched his way to the door of the sacristy. It took a little time under the final light to identify the two keys and let himself in. He switched on the light beside the door, then punched out the code to silence the low, insistent ringing of the alarm system, and went through into the body of the church. The switch for the two rows of ceiling lights over the nave was to his right, and he put out his hand to press it down, then saw with a small shock of surprise, but no anxiety, that the spotlight which illuminated the doom was on, so that the west end of the church was bathed in its reflected glow. Without switching on the nave lights, he moved along the north wall, his shadow moving with him on the stone. Then he reached the doom and stood transfixed at the horror that lay sprawled at his feet. The blood hadn't gone away. It was here, in the very place in which he was seeking sanctuary, as red as in his nightmare, not rising like a strong feathered fountain, but spread in blotches and rivulets over the stone floor. The stream was no longer moving, but seemed to quiver and become viscous as he gazed. The nightmare hadn't ended. He was still trapped in a place of horror, but one which he couldn't now escape by waking. That, or he was mad. He shut his eyes and prayed, "Dear God, help me." Then his conscious mind took hold, and he opened his eyes and willed himself to look again. His senses, unable to apprehend the whole scene and the enormity of its horror, were registering it by slow degrees, detail by detail. The smashed skull, the archdeacon's spectacles lying a little apart but unbroken, the two brass candlesticks placed one on each side of the body as if in an act of sacrilegious contempt, the archdeacon's hands stretched out, seeming to clutch at the stones but looking whiter, more delicate than his hands had looked in life, the purple padded dressing gown stiffening with his blood. Finally, Father Martin raised his eyes to the doom. The dancing devil in the front of the picture now wore spectacles, a moustache, and a short beard, and his right arm had been elongated in a gesture of vulgar defiance. At the foot of the doom was a small tin of black paint with a brush lying neatly over the lid. Father Martin staggered forward and dropped to his knees beside the archdeacon's head. He tried to pray, but the words wouldn't come. Suddenly, he needed to see other human beings, to hear human feet and human noises, to know the comfort of human companionship. Without thinking clearly, he staggered to the west of the church and gave one vigorous tug on the bell pull. The bell sang out as sweetly as ever, but seeming to his ears clamorous in its dread. Then he went to the south door and, with trembling hands, managed at last to draw back the heavy iron bolts. The wind rushed in, bringing with it a few torn leaves. He left it ajar and walked, more strongly and firmly now, back to the body. There were words he had to say, and now he found the strength to say them. He was still on his knees, the edge of his cloak trailing in the blood, when he heard footsteps and then a woman's voice. Emma knelt beside him and put her arms round his shoulders. He felt the soft brush of her hair against his cheek, and could smell her sweet, delicately scented skin driving from his mind the metallic smell of blood. He could feel her tremble, but her voice was calm. She said, "Come away, Father. Come away now. It's all right." But it wasn't all right. It was never going to be all right again. He tried to look up at her but couldn't raise his head. Only his lips could move. He whispered, "Oh God, what have we done? What have we done?" And then he felt her arms tighten in terror. Behind them, the great south door was creaking wider open. 3. Dalgliesh usually had little difficulty in getting to sleep, even in an unfamiliar bed. Years of working as a detective had inured his body to the discomforts of a variety of couches and, provided he had a bedside light or a torch for the brief period of reading which was necessary for him before sleep came, his mind could usually let go of the day as easily as did his tired limbs. Tonight was different. His room was propitious for sleep. The bed was comfortable without being soft. The bedside lamp was at the right height for reading. The bedclothes were adequate. But he took up his copy of Seamus Heaney's translation of Beowulf and read the first 5 pages with a dogged persistence, as if this were a prescribed nightly ritual instead of a long-awaited pleasure. But soon the poetry took hold, and he read steadily until 11 o'clock, then switched off the lamp and composed himself for sleep. But tonight it didn't come. That welcome moment eluded him when the mind slips free of the burden of consciousness and sinks unafraid into its little diurnal death. Perhaps it was the fury of the wind keeping him awake. Normally he liked to lie in bed and fall asleep to the sound of a storm, but this storm was different. There would be a lull in the wind, a brief period of total anticipatory peace, followed by a low moaning, rising into a howling like a chorus of demented demons. In these crescendos, he could hear the great horse chestnut groaning and had a sudden vision of snapping boughs, of the scarred trunk toppling, first as if reluctant and then in a terrifying plunge to thrust its upper branches through the bedroom window. And, always a vibrant accompaniment to the tumult of the wind, he could hear the pounding of the sea. It seemed impossible that anything living could stand up to this assault of wind and water. In a period of calm, he switched on the bedside light and looked at his watch. He was surprised to see that it was 5:35, so he must have slept, or at least dozed, for over 6 hours. He was beginning to wonder whether the storm had really spent its force, when the moaning began again and rose to another howling crescendo. In the lull that followed, his ears caught a different sound, and one so familiar from childhood that he recognized it instantly, the peal of a church bell. It was a single peal, clear and sweet. For a second only, he wondered if the sound was the remnant of some half-forgotten dream. Then reality took hold. He had been fully awake. He knew what he had heard. He listened intently, but there was no further peal. He acted swiftly. By long habit, he never went to bed without carefully placing to hand the items he might need in an emergency. He pulled on his dressing gown, rejected slippers in favor of shoes, and took a torch, heavy as a weapon, from his bedside table. Leaving the apartment in darkness, and guided only by the torch, he closed the front door quietly behind him and stepped into a sudden gusting wind and a flurry of leaves which whirled round his head like a flock of frantic birds. The row of low-powered wall lights along both the north and south cloisters were sufficient only to outline the slender pillars and cast an eerie glow over the paving stones. The great house was in darkness, and he saw no lights from any window except in Ambrose, next door, where he knew Emma was sleeping. Running past, without pausing to call out to her, he felt a clutch of fear. A faint slit of light showed that the great south door of the church was ajar. The oak groaned on its hinges as he pushed it open, then closed it behind him. For a few seconds, no more, he stood transfixed by the tableau before him. There was no obstacle between him and the doom, and he saw it framed by 2 stone pillars, so brightly lit that the faded colors seemed to glow with an unimagined, newly painted richness. The shock of its black defacement paled before the greater enormity at his feet. The sprawled figure of the archdeacon lay prone before it, as if in an extremity of worship. 2 heavy brass candlesticks stood ceremoniously, one on each side of his head. The pool of blood was surely more lusciously red than any human blood. Even the 2 human figures looked unreal. The white-haired priest in his spreading black cloak, kneeling and almost embracing the body, and the girl crouched beside him with an arm round his shoulder. For a moment, disorientated, he could almost imagine that the black devils had sprung from the doom and were dancing round her head. At the sound of the door, she turned her head, then was instantly upright and ran towards him. "Thank God you've come." She clutched at him, and he knew as he put his arms round her and felt the trembling of her body that the gesture was an instinctive impulse of relief. She broke free at once and said, "It's Father Martin. I can't make him move." Father Martin's left arm, stretched over Crampton's body, had its palm planted in the pool of blood. Putting down his torch, Dalgliesh placed his hand on the priest's shoulder and said gently, "It's Adam, Father. Come away now. I'm here. It's all right." But of course it wasn't all right. Even as he spoke the anodyne words, their falsity jarred. Father Martin didn't move, and the shoulder under Dalgliesh's touch was stiff as if locked in rigor mortis. Dalgliesh said again, more strongly, "Let go, Father. You must come away now. There's nothing you can do here." And this time, as if the words had at last reached him, Father Martin allowed himself to be helped to his feet. He looked at his bloodied hand with a kind of childish wonder, then wiped it down the side of his cloak. "And that," thought Dalgliesh, "will complicate the examination for blood." Compassion for his companions was overlaid with more urgent preoccupations. The imperative to preserve the scene from contamination as far as possible, and the need to ensure that the method of murder was kept secret. If the south door had, as usual, been bolted, the killer must have come in from the sacristy and through the north cloister. Gently, and with Emma supporting the priest on his right side, he led Father Martin towards the row of chairs nearest the door. He settled them both down and said to Emma, "Wait here for a few minutes. I won't be long. I'll bolt the south door and go out through the sacristy. I'll lock it after me. Don't let anyone in." He turned to Father Martin. "Can you hear me, Father?" Father Martin looked up for the first time and their eyes met. The pain and horror were almost more than Dalgliesh could bear to meet. "Yes, yes, I'm all right. I'm so sorry, Adam. I've behaved badly. I'm all right now." He was very far from all right, but at least he seemed able to take in what was being said. Dalgliesh said, "There's one thing I have to say now. I'm sorry if it sounds insensitive, the wrong time to ask, but it is important. Don't tell anyone what you have seen this morning. No one. Do you both understand that?" They murmured a low assent. Then Father Martin said more clearly, "We understand." Dalgliesh was turning to go when Emma said, "He isn't still here, is he? He isn't hiding somewhere in the church." "He won't be here, but I'm going to look now." He was unwilling to put on any more lights. Apparently, only he and Emma had been woken by the church bell. The last thing he wanted was other people crowding the scene. He returned to the south door and shot its great iron bolt. Torch in hand, he made a swift but methodical examination of the church, as much for her satisfaction as his. Long experience had shown him almost immediately that this was no very recent death. He opened the gates to the two box pews and swept the torch over the seats, then knelt and looked beneath them. And here was a find. Someone had occupied the second pew. A portion of the seat was free of dust, and when he knelt and shone the torch in the deep recess beneath it, it was apparent that someone had crouched there. He ended his quick but thorough search and went back to the two seated figures. He said, "It's all right. There's no one here but us. Is the sacristy door locked, Father?" "Yes. Yes, it is. I locked it after me." "Will you give me the keys, please?" Father Martin fumbled in the pocket of his cloak and handed over a bunch. It took a little time for his shaking fingers to find the right keys. Dalgliesh said again, "I won't be long. I'll lock the door behind me. Will you be all right until I come back?" Emma said, "I don't think Father Martin ought to stay here long. He won't have to." It should, thought Dalgliesh, take only a matter of minutes to fetch Roger Yarwood. Whichever force took on this investigation, he needed help now. There was, too, a question of protocol. Yarwood was an officer of the Suffolk Police. Until the chief constable decided which of his officers should take over, Yarwood would be temporarily in charge. He was relieved to find a handkerchief in his dressing-gown pocket, and used this to ensure that he made no print on the sacristy door. Resetting the alarm and locking the door behind him, he plunged through a mush of fallen leaves, now inches deep in the north cloister, and hurried back to the guest apartments. Roger Yarwood, he remembered, was in Gregory. The set was in darkness, and he passed, by the light of the torch, through the sitting-room and called up the stairs. There was no reply. He went up to the bedroom and found that the door was open. Yarwood had gone to bed, but now the bedclothes had been thrown back. Dalgleish opened the door to the shower and found it was empty. He switched on the light and quickly checked the wardrobe. There was no overcoat, and he could see no shoes other than Yarwood's slippers by the bed. Yarwood must at some time have walked out into the storm. It would be pointless for him to start searching alone. Yarwood could be anywhere on the headland. Instead, he went back at once to the church. Emma and Father Martin were sitting just as he had left them. He said gently, "Father, why don't you and Dr. Lavenham go to her sitting-room? She can make some tea for you both. I expect Father Sebastian will want to speak to the whole college, but you could wait there quietly and rest for the time being." Father Martin looked up. His eyes held something of the piteous puzzlement of a child. He said, "But Father Sebastian will want me." It was Emma who replied. "Of course he will. But hadn't we better wait until Commander Dalgleish has spoken to him? The best plan is to go to my sitting-room. There's everything there for making tea. I know I should like it." Father Martin nodded and got up. Dalgleish said, "Before you leave, Father, we must check whether the safe has been tampered with." They went into the sacristy, and Dalgleish asked for the combination. Then, with his handkerchief covering his fingers to preserve any prints which might be on the knob of the combination lock, he turned it carefully and opened the door. Inside, on top of a number of documents, was a large drawstring bag in soft leather. He took it to the desk and opened it to reveal, wrapped in white silk, two magnificent pre-Reformation jeweled chalices and a pattern, a gift from the founder to St. Anselm's. Father Martin said quietly, "Nothing is missing." And Dalgleish returned the bag to the safe and turned the combination lock. So the motive wasn't robbery, but he hadn't for a moment supposed that it was. He waited until Emma and Father Martin had left by the south door, then bolted it behind them and went out of the sacristy into the leaf-covered north cloister. The storm was beginning to spend its force, and, although its devastation lay about him in snapped boughs and fallen leaves, the wind was abating now to little more than strong gusts. He let himself in through the north cloister door and made his way up two flights of stairs to the warden's flat. Father Sebastian came quickly to his knock. He was wearing a wool-plaid dressing-gown, but his tousled hair made him look curiously young. The two men gazed at each other. Even before he spoke, Dalgleish felt that the warden knew the words he had come to speak. They were stark, but there was no easy or gentle way of giving this news. He said, "Archdeacon Crampton has been murdered. Father Martin found his body in the church immediately after 5:30 this morning." The warden put his hand in his pocket and drew out his wristwatch. He said, "And it's now just after 6. Why wasn't I told earlier?" Father Martin rang the church bell to raise the alarm, and I heard it. So did Dr. Lavenham, who was first on the scene. There were things I had to do, and now I must phone the Suffolk Police. But isn't this a matter initially for Inspector Yarwood? It would be. Yarwood is missing. May I use your office, Father? Of course. I'll put on some clothes and join you. Does anyone else know of this?
Not yet, Father.
Then I must be the one to tell them. He closed the door, and Dalgleish made his way to the office on the floor below. 4. The Suffolk number he needed was in the wallet in his room, but after a couple of seconds' thought he was able to recall it. Once his identity was established, he was given the chief constable's number. After that, it was quick and simple. He was dealing with men not unused to being woken with the need for decision and action. He reported fully but briefly. Nothing needed to be said twice. There was a silence of some 5 seconds before the chief constable spoke.
Yarwood disappearing is a major complication.
Alred Treves is another, but less important. Still, I don't see how we can take this on. We can't waste time. The first 3 days are always the most vital. I'll speak to the commissioner. But you'll want a search party?
Not yet.
Yarwood may just have wandered off. He may even have returned by now. If not, I'll get some of the students here to search at first light. I'll report when there's any news. If he's not found, you'd better take over.
Right. Your own people will confirm, but I think you'd better assume that the case is yours.
I'll discuss details with the Met, but I imagine you'll want your own team.
That would be simpler.
It was only then that, after pausing again, the chief constable said,
I know something of St. Anselm's. They're good people.
Will you give Father Sebastian my sympathy? This is going to hurt them in more ways than one. In another 5 minutes, the yard had rung with the details which had been agreed. Dalgleish would take the case. Detective Inspectors Kate Miskin and Piers Tarrant with Sergeant Robbins were on their way by car, and the supporting team of photographer and 3 scene-of-crime officers would follow. Since Dalgleish was already there, it wasn't considered necessary to incur the expense of a helicopter. The team would arrive by train at Ipswich, and the Suffolk police would arrange transport to the college. Dr. Kynaston, the forensic pathologist with whom Dalgleish usually worked, was already at a crime scene and likely to be tied up for the rest of the day. The local Home Office pathologist was on leave in New York, but his substitute, Dr. Mark Ayling, was on call and available. It would seem sensible to use him. Any urgent material for forensic examination could go either to the Huntington or to the Lambeth lab, depending on their workloads. Father Sebastian had tactfully waited in the outer office while Dalgleish was telephoning. Hearing that the conversation seemed finally to have ended, he came in and said,
I should like now to go to the church.
You have your responsibilities, Commander, but I have mine. Dalgleish said, It's urgent first to get a search started for Roger Yarwood. Who is your most sensible ordnant for this kind of job?
Stephen Morby. I suggest he and Pilbeam take the Land Rover.
He went to the telephone on his desk. It was quickly answered.
Good morning, Pilbeam. Are you dressed?
Good.
Would you please wake Mr. Morby, and both of you come to my office immediately?
The wait was not long before Dalgleish heard footsteps hurrying up the stairs. A pause at the door and the 2 men came in. He hadn't before seen Pilbeam. The man was tall, certainly over 6 foot, strongly built and thick-necked, with a tanned and rugged country face under thinning straw-coloured hair. Dalgleish thought that there was something familiar about him, then realized that he was remarkably like an actor, whose name he couldn't recall but who frequently appeared in war films, in the supporting role of the inarticulate but dependable NCO, who invariably died uncomplainingly in the last reel to the greater glory of the hero. He stood waiting, totally at ease. Beside him, Stephen Morby, no weakling, looked a boy. It was to Pilbeam that Father Sebastian spoke.
Mr. Yarwood is missing.
I'm afraid he may have gone wandering again.
It was a bad night for wandering, Father.
Exactly. He may return any minute, but I don't think we should wait. I want you and Mr. Morby to take the Land Rover and look for him. Your mobile phone is working?
It is, Father.
Ring at once if there's any news. If he's not on the headland or near the mere, don't waste time going further. It may then be a matter for the police. And Pilbeam?
Yes, Father.
When you and Mr. Morby return, whether or not with Mr. Yarwood, report at once to me without speaking to anyone else.
That goes for you too, Stephen. Do you understand?
Yes, Father.
Stephen Morby said, Something's happened, hasn't it? something more than Mr. Yarwood wandering off.
I shall explain when you return. You may not be able to do much until full light, but I want you to get started. Take torches, blankets, and hot coffee, and Pilbeam. I shall be speaking to the whole community at 7:30 in the library. Will you ask your wife to be good enough to join us?
Yes, Father.
They went out. Father Sebastian said, they're both sensible. If Yarwood is on the headland, they'll find him. I thought it right to delay explanation until they return.
I think that was wise.
It was becoming apparent that Father Sebastian's natural authoritarianism was quickly adjusting to unfamiliar circumstances. Dalgliesh reflected that to have a suspect taking an active part in the investigation was a novelty he could well dispense with. The situation would need careful handling.
The warden said, "You were right, of course. Finding Yarwood has priority. But now, perhaps, I may go where I should be, at the Archdeacon's side."
"Some questions first, Father. How many keys to the church, and who holds them?"
"Is this really necessary now?"
"Yes, Father. As you said, you have your responsibilities, and I have mine.
And yours must take precedence?"
"For the present, yes." Father Sebastian was careful to keep his impatience out of his voice. He said, "There are 7 sets comprising the 2 keys to the sacristy door, 1 a security Chubb and 1 a Yale. The south door has bolts only. Each of the 4 resident priests holds a set. The other 3 are in the key cupboard next door in Miss Ramsay's office. It is necessary to keep the church locked because of the value of the altarpiece and silver, but all ordinands may sign for the keys if they need to go to the church. The students, not the domestic staff, are responsible for the cleaning."
"And the staff and visitors?"
"They only have access to the church when accompanied by a key holder, except during the times of the services. As we have 4 services a day, morning prayer, the Eucharist, evening prayer, and compline, they are hardly deprived.
I dislike the restriction, but it is the price we pay for keeping the Van der Weyden over the altar.
The problem is that the young are not always conscientious about resetting the alarm. All the staff and the visitors have keys to the iron gate leading from the west court out to the headland."
"And who in college will know the code for the alarm system?"
"I imagine everyone. We are guarding our treasures against intruders, not against each other."
"What keys do the ordnance have?"
"They each have 2 keys. One to the iron gate, which is their usual mode of entrance, and one to the door either in the north or south cloister, depending on the situation of their rooms. And none of them has keys to the church."
"And Ronald Treve's keys were returned here after his death?"
"Yes. They're in a drawer in Miss Ramsay's office. But he didn't, of course, have keys to the church."
"And now I wish to go to the Archdeacon."
"Of course.
On the way, Father, we can check if the 3 spare sets of the keys to the church are in the key cupboard."
Father Sebastian didn't reply. As they passed through the outer office, he went over to a narrow cupboard to the left of the fireplace. It was not locked. Inside were 2 rows of hooks holding named keys. There were 3 hooks on the first row labeled Church. 1 was empty. Dalgliesh said, "Can you remember when you last saw the church keys, Father?"
Father Sebastian thought for a moment and said,
"I think it was yesterday morning, before lunch. Some paint was delivered for Surtees to paint the sacristy. Pilbeam came in to collect a set of keys, and I was here in the office when he signed for them, and still here when he returned them less than 5 minutes later."
He went to the right drawer in Miss Ramsay's desk and drew out a book.
"I think you'll find here that this was the last entry for the keys. As you see, he held them for no more than 5 minutes. But the last person to see them would have been Henry Bloxham. He was responsible for making the church ready for compline last night. I was here when he collected a set of keys and in my office next door when he returned them. If there had been a set missing, he would have said so."
"Did you actually see him return the keys, Father?"
No, I was in my office. But the door between the rooms was open, and he called good night. There will be no entry in the key book.
Ordnance who collect the keys before a service are not required to sign it. And now, Commander, I must insist that we go to the church. The house was still in silence. They passed without speaking over the tessellated floor of the hall. Father Sebastian was moving towards the door through the cloakroom, but Dalgliesh said, "We'll avoid the north cloister as far as possible." Nothing more was said until they reached the sacristy door. Father Sebastian fumbled for his keys, but Dalgliesh said, "I'll do this, Father." He unlocked the door, locked it after them, and they passed into the church. He had left on the light over the doom, and the horror at its foot was clearly visible. Father Sebastian's steps didn't falter as he moved towards it. He didn't speak, but looked first at the desecration of the painting, and then down at his dead adversary. Then he made the sign of the cross and knelt in silent prayer. Watching him, Dalgliesh wondered what words Father Sebastian was finding to communicate with his God. He could hardly be praying for the Archdeacon's soul. That would have been anathema to Crampton's uncompromising Protestantism. He wondered, too, what words he would find appropriate if he were praying at this moment. "Help me to solve this case with the least pain to the innocent, and protect my team." The last time he remembered having prayed with passion and with the belief that his prayer was valid had been when his wife was dying, and it had not been heard, or, if heard, had not been answered. He thought about death, its finality, its inevitability. Was part of the attraction of his job the illusion it gave that death was a mystery that could be solved, and that with the solution all the unruly passions of life, all doubts and all fears, could be folded away like a garment? And then he heard Father Sebastian speaking, as if he had become aware of Dalgliesh's silent presence and needed to involve him, even if only as a listener, in his secret ministry of expiation. The familiar words spoken in his beautiful voice were an affirmation, not a prayer, and they so uncannily echoed Dalgliesh's thoughts that he heard them as if for the first time, and with a frisson of awe. "And thou, Lord, in the beginning hast laid the foundation of the earth, and the heavens are the works of thine hands. They shall perish, but thou remainest, and they shall wax old as doth a garment, and as a vesture shalt thou fold them up, and they shall be changed. But thou art the same, and thy years shall not fail." 5. Dalgliesh shaved, showered, and dressed with practice speed, and by 7:25 had again joined the warden in his office. Father Sebastian looked at his wristwatch. "It's time to go to the library. I'll say a few words first, and then you can take over. Is that acceptable?" "Perfectly." It was the first time on this visit that Dalgliesh had been in the library. Father Sebastian switched on a series of lights, which curved down over the shelves, and immediately memory came rushing back, of long summer evenings, reading here under the sightless eyes of the busts ranged along the top of the shelves, of the western sun burnishing the leather spines and throwing gules of coloured light over polished wood, of long evenings when the boom of the sea seemed to strengthen with the dying light. But now the high-barreled ceiling was in gloom, and the stained glass in the pointed windows was a black void patterned with lead. Along the northern wall, a row of bookshelves jutting at right angles between the windows formed cubicles, each with a double reading desk and chair. Father Sebastian went to the nearest cubicle, swung up two chairs, and placed them together in the middle of the room. He said, "We'll need four chairs, three for the women and one for Peter Buckhurst. He's not yet strong enough to stand for long, not that this will take long, I imagine. There's no point in putting out a chair for Father John's sister. She's elderly and hardly ever shows herself outside their flat." Without replying, Dalgliesh helped to carry the last two chairs, and Father Sebastian arranged them in line, then stood back as if assessing the accuracy of their placement. There was the sound of soft footfalls across the hall, and the three ordnans, all wearing their black cassocks, came in together as if by prior arrangement, and took their stand behind the chairs. They stood upright and very still, their faces set and pale, their eyes fixed on Father Sebastian. The tension they brought into the room was palpable. They were followed in less than a minute by Mrs. Pilbeam and Emma. Father Sebastian indicated the chairs with a gesture, and without speaking the two women sat down, leaning a little towards each other, as if there could be comfort even in the slight touch of a shoulder. Mrs. Pilbeam, in recognition of the importance of the occasion, had taken off her white working overall and looked incongruously festive, in a green woolen skirt and pale blue blouse adorned with a large brooch at the neck. Emma was very pale, but had taken care in dressing, as if attempting to impose order and normality on the disruption of murder. Her brown low-heeled shoes were highly polished, and she wore fawn corduroy trousers, a cream blouse which looked freshly ironed, and a leather jerkin. Father Sebastian said to Buckhurst, "Won't you sit, Peter?"
"I'd rather stand, Father."
"I'd prefer you to sit." Without further demur, Peter Buckhurst took the seat beside Emma. Next came the three priests. Father John and Father Peregrine stood one on each end of the ordinance. Father Martin, as if recognizing an unspoken invitation, came and stood beside Father Sebastian. Father John said, "I'm afraid my sister is still asleep, and I didn't like to wake her. If she's needed, perhaps she could be seen later." Dalgleish murmured, "Of course." He saw Emma look at Father Martin with loving concern, and half rise in her chair. He thought, "She's kind as well as clever and beautiful." His heart lurched, a sensation as unfamiliar as it was unwelcome. He thought, "Oh God, not that complication. Not now, not ever." And still they waited. Seconds lengthened into minutes before they again heard footsteps. The door opened and George Gregory entered, closely followed by Clive Stannard. Stannard had either overslept or had seen no reason to inconvenience himself. He had put on his trousers and a tweed jacket over his pyjamas, and the striped cotton showed plainly at his neck and was ruched over his shoes. Gregory, in contrast, had dressed with care, his shirt and tie immaculate. Gregory said, "I'm sorry if I've kept you waiting. I dislike putting on my clothes before I've showered." He took his stand behind Emma and rested his hand on the back of her chair, then quietly slid it away, apparently feeling the gesture had been inappropriate. His eyes, fixed on Father Sebastian, were wary, but Dalgleish thought he detected a hint of amused curiosity. Stannard was, he thought, frankly frightened, and attempting to conceal it by a nonchalance which was as contrived as it was embarrassing. He said, "Isn't it a bit early for drama? I take it that something's happened. Hadn't we better know?" No one replied. The door opened again, and the last arrivals came in. Eric Surtees was in his working clothes. He hesitated at the door and cast a look of puzzled inquiry at Dalgleish, as if surprised to find him present. Karen Surtees, bright as a parrot in a long red sweater over green trousers, had taken time only to apply a coat of bright red lipstick. Her eyes, denuded of makeup, looked drained and full of sleep. After a moment's hesitation, she took the vacant chair, and her brother moved behind her. All those summoned were now present. Dalgleish thought that they looked like an ill-assorted wedding group, reluctantly posing for an over-enthusiastic photographer. Father Sebastian said, "Let us pray." The exhortation was unexpected. Only the priests and the ordinands responded instinctively by bowing their heads and clasping their hands. The women seemed uncertain what was expected of them, but after a glance at Father Martin, stood up. Emma and Mrs. Pilbeam bowed their heads, and Karen Surtees stared at Dalgliesh with belligerent disbelief, as if holding him personally responsible for the embarrassing debacle. Gregory, smiling, stared straight ahead, and Stannard frowned and shifted his feet. Father Sebastian spoke the words of the morning collect. He paused and then said the prayer which he had spoken at Compline some 10 hours earlier. Visit, we beseech thee, O Lord, this place, and drive from it all the snares of the enemy. Let thy holy angels dwell herein to preserve us in peace, and may thy blessing be upon us evermore. Through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen. There was a chorus of amen, subdued from the women, more confident from the ordinance, and the group stirred. It was less a movement than a release of breath. Dalgliesh thought, they know now. Of course they know. But one of them has known from the beginning. The women again sat down. Dalgliesh felt the intensity of the gaze fixed on the warden. When he began speaking, his voice was calm and almost expressionless. Last night, a great evil came into our community. Archdeacon Crampton has been brutally murdered in the church. His body was discovered by Father Martin at 5:30 this morning. Commander Dalgliesh, who was here as our guest on another matter, is still our guest but is now among us as a police officer investigating a murder. It will be our duty as well as our wish to give him every possible assistance by answering his questions fully and honestly, and by doing nothing either by word or action to hinder the police or to make them feel that their presence here is unwelcome. I have telephoned those ordnance who are away this weekend and deferred for a week those due to return this morning. Those of us now here must try to continue the life and work of the college while cooperating fully with the police. I have put St. Matthew's Cottage at Mr. Dalgliesh's disposal, and the police will be working from there. At Mr. Dalgliesh's request, the church and the access to the North Cloister are both closed, as is the cloister itself. Mass will be said in the oratory at the usual time, and all services will be held there until the church has been reopened and made ready for divine service. The Archdeacon's death is now a matter for the police. Don't speculate, don't gossip among yourselves. Murder, of course, cannot be kept hidden. Inevitably, this news will break in the church and in the wider world. I would ask you not to telephone or communicate the news in any way outside these walls. We can hope for at least one day of peace. If there are any matters worrying you, Father Martin and I are here. He paused and then added, as always. And now I will ask Mr. Dalgliesh to take over. His audience had listened in almost total silence. Only at the sonorous word, murdered, did Dalgliesh hear a quick intake of breath and a frail cry quickly suppressed, which he thought came from Mrs. Pilbeam. Raphael, white-faced, was so rigid that Dalgliesh feared he was about to keel over. Eric Surtees shot a terrified glance at his sister, then looked quickly away and fixed his eyes on Father Sebastian. Gregory was frowning in intense concentration. The still, cold air was charged with fear. Apart from Surtees' glance at his sister, none of them met each other's eyes. Perhaps, thought Dalgliesh, they were afraid of what they might see. Dalgliesh was interested that Father Sebastian had made no mention of the absence of Yarwood, Pilbeam, and Stephen Morby, and was grateful for his discretion. He decided to be brief. It wasn't his habit when investigating murder to apologize for the inconvenience caused. Inconvenience to those involved was the least of murder's contaminating evils. He said, "It has been agreed that the Metropolitan Police shall take over this case. A small team of police officers and support services will be arriving this morning. As Father Sebastian has said, the church is closed, as is the north cloister and the door leading from the house to that cloister. I, myself, or one of my officers will be speaking to you all sometime today. However, it would save time if we could establish one fact at once. Did anyone here leave his or her room last night after Compline? Did anyone go near or into the church? Did any of you see or hear anything last night that could have had a bearing on this crime? There was silence. Then Henry said, I went out just after 10:30 for some air and exercise. I walked briskly about 5 times round the cloisters and then went back to my room. I'm number 2 on the south cloister. I saw and heard nothing unusual. The wind was getting up strongly by then and blowing showers of leaves into the north cloister. That's chiefly what I remember. Dalgleish said, you were the ordnant who lit the candles in church before Compline and opened the south door. Did you fetch the church key from the outer office? Yes. I fetched it just before the service and returned it afterwards. There were 3 keys when I collected it, and 3 after I'd taken it back. Dalgleish said, I'll ask again. Did any of you leave your room after Compline? He waited for a moment, but there was no response. He went on. I shall want to see the shoes and clothes that you were wearing yesterday evening, and it will later be necessary to take the fingerprints of everyone in St. Anselm's for the purposes of elimination. I think that's all for the present. Again there was a silence. Then Gregory spoke. A question for Mr. Dalgleish. 3 people seem to be missing, among them an officer of the Suffolk Police. Is there any significance in that fact? I mean for the thrust of the investigation? Dalgleish said, at present none. This breaking of the silence provoked Stannard into querulous speech. He said, can I ask why the commander is assuming that this must be what I think the police describe as an inside job? While we are having clothes examined and fingerprints taken, the person responsible is probably miles away. After all, this place is hardly secure. I, for one, don't intend to sleep here tonight without a lock on my door. Father Sebastian said, your concern is natural. I'm arranging for locks to be fitted to your room and to the 4 guest sets, and keys to be provided. And what about my question? Why the assumption that it must have been one of us? It was the first time that this possibility had been spoken aloud, and it seemed to Dalgleish that everyone present was determined to stare ahead, as if any glance might convey an accusation. He said, no assumptions are being made. Father Sebastian said, the closing of the North Cloister will mean that ordnance with rooms there will have temporarily to vacate them. With so many students absent, that applies at present only to you, Raphael. If you will hand over your keys, a key to number 3 in the south cloister and to the south corridor door will be given in exchange. What about my things, Father? Books and clothes? Can't I fetch them? You must manage without them for the present. Your fellow students will be able to lend you what you need. I can't emphasize too strongly the importance of keeping away from any area which the police have put out of bounds. Without another word, Raphael took a bunch of keys from his pocket, detached 2 and stepping forward, handed them to Father Sebastian. Dalgleish said, I understand that all the resident priests have keys to the church. Could you please check now that they're in your possession? Father John Betterton spoke for the first time. I'm afraid I haven't my keys with me. I always leave them on a table by my bed. Dalgleish still had Father Martin's bunch of keys, which he had taken in the church, and now he moved to the 2 other priests, checking that the church keys were still on their rings. He turned to Father Sebastian, who said, I think that's all that needs to be said at present. The timetable set up for today will be kept as far as possible. There will be no morning prayer, but I propose to say Mass in the oratory at midday. Thank you. He turned and walked steadily out of the room. There was a shuffling of feet. The little company looked at each other and then, one by one, made for the door. Dalgleish had switched off his mobile telephone during the meeting, but now it rang. It was Stephen Morby. Commander Dalgleish, we've found Inspector Yarwood.
He'd fallen into a ditch about halfway down the approach road. I tried to ring earlier but couldn't get through. He's been partly lying in water, and he's unconscious. We think he's broken a leg. We didn't like to move him because of making the injury worse, but we felt we couldn't leave him where he was. We got him out as carefully as we could and rang for an ambulance. He's being loaded into it now. They're taking him to Ipswich Hospital.
Dalglish asked.
You did the right thing. How bad is he?
The paramedics think he should be all right, but he hasn't regained consciousness.
I'm going with him in the ambulance. I'll be able to tell you more when I get back.
Mr. Pilbeam is driving behind us, so I'll come back with him.
Dalglish said, Right. Be as quick as you can. You're both needed here.
He gave the news to Father Sebastian.
The warden said, It's what I feared had happened. This had been the pattern of his illness. I understand it's a kind of claustrophobia, and when it comes on him, he has to get into the open air and walk. After his wife left him, taking the children, he used to disappear for days. Sometimes he walked until he collapsed, and the police found him and brought him back. Thank God he's been found, and it seems in time.
And now, perhaps, if you'll come to the study, we can discuss what you and your colleagues will need in St. Matthew's Cottage.
Later, Father. I need first to see the Bettertons.
I think Father John went back to their flat. It's on the third floor on the north side.
No doubt he'll be looking out for you.
Father Sebastian had been too shrewd to speculate aloud about Yarwood's possible implication in the murder. But surely Christian charity only extended so far. With part of his mind he must have hoped that here was the best possible outcome. A killing by a man temporarily not responsible for his actions. And if Yarwood didn't survive, he would always remain a suspect. His death could be very convenient for someone. Before making his way to the Bettertons' flat, Dalglish went back to his own apartment and rang the chief constable.
6.
There was a bell beside the narrow oak door to the Bettertons' flat, but Dalglish had barely pressed it before Father John appeared and ushered him in. He said, If you wouldn't mind just waiting a moment, I'll fetch my sister. I think she's in the kitchen. We have a very small kitchen here in the flat, and she prefers to eat separately rather than join the community for meals. I won't be a moment. The room in which Dalglish found himself was low-ceilinged but large, with four OG-shaped windows facing the sea. The room was over-furnished with what looked like the relics of earlier homes. Low padded chairs with button backs, a sofa facing the fireplace with a sagging seat, its back covered with a throw in Indian cotton, a round central table in solid mahogany with six chairs discordant in age and style, a pedestal desk set between two of the windows, an assortment of small tables, each laden with the miscellany of two long lives, photographs in silver frames, some porcelain figures, boxes in wood and silver, and a bowl of potpourri whose stale and dusty perfume had long since spent itself on the stuffy air. The wall to the left of the door was completely covered with a bookcase. Here was the library of Father John's youth, student days and priesthood, but there was also a row of black-covered volumes labeled Plays of the Year, dating back from the 1930s and 40s. Beside them was a row of paperback detective stories. Dalglish saw that Father John was addicted to the women writers of the Golden Age, Dorothy L. Sayers, Marjorie Allingham, and Niall Marsh. To the right of the door was propped a golf bag holding some half-dozen clubs. It was an incongruous object to find in a room which bore no other evidence of interest in sport. The pictures were as varied as the other artifacts, Victorian oils, highly sentimental in subject but competent in execution, floral prints, a couple of samplers and watercolours which were probably the work of Victorian forebears. They looked too good to be the work of amateurs, but not good enough for professionals. but despite the gloom, the room was too obviously lived in, too idiosyncratic and too comfortable to be depressing. The two high-backed armchairs on each side of the fire had beside them a table with an angle-poise lamp. Here brother and sister, facing each other, could sit and read in comfort. As soon as Miss Betterton entered, Dalgliesh was struck by the odd disparity produced by the eccentric patterning of family genes. At first sight it was difficult to believe that the two Bettertons were closely related. Father John was short, with a compact body and a gentle face, which wore an air of perpetual anxious puzzlement. His sister was at least 6 inches taller, with an angular body and sharp, suspicious eyes. Only the similarity of the long-lobed ears, the droop of the eyelids, and the small, pursed mouths proclaimed any family likeness. She looked considerably older than her brother. Her steel-grey hair was pulled back into a pleat, anchored to the top of her head by a comb from which the ends of her dry hair stuck out like an ornamental frieze. She was wearing a skirt in thin tweed almost to the floor, a striped shirt which looked as if it were one of her brother's, and a long fawn cardigan in which the moth holes in the sleeves were clearly visible. Father John said, "Agatha, this is Commander Dalgliesh from New Scotland Yard."
"A policeman?"
Dalgliesh put out his hand. He said, "Yes, Miss Betterton, I'm a policeman." The hand, which, after a second's delay, was pressed into his hand, was cool and so thin that he could feel every bone. She said, in that fluting, upper-class voice, which those who don't possess it find difficult to believe can ever be natural, "I'm afraid you've come to the wrong place, my man. We haven't any dogs here."
"Mr. Dalgliesh doesn't have anything to do with dogs, Agatha."
"I thought you said he was a dog handler."
"No, I said commander, not dog handler."
"Well, we haven't any ships either."
She turned to Dalgliesh.
"Cousin Raymond was a commander in the last war, the Royal Navy Volunteer Reserve, not the proper navy. The Wavy Navy, I believe they called them, because of the wavy gold stripes on their sleeves. He got killed anyway, so it made no difference. You may have noticed his golf clubs beside the door. One cannot imbue a niblick with much sentiment, but one is reluctant to part with the clubs. Why aren't you in uniform, Mr. Dalgliesh? I like to see a man in uniform. A cassock is not the same."
"I'm a police commander, Miss Betterton. It's a rank peculiar to the Metropolitan Police, nothing to do with the Navy."
Father John, obviously feeling that the dialogue had gone on long enough, interposed. His voice was kind but firm. "Agatha, dear, something very terrible has happened. I want you to listen carefully and stay very calm. Archdeacon Crampton has been found murdered. That's why Commander Dalgliesh needs to talk to you, to all of us. We must help him in any way we can to find out who was responsible for this terrible act." His exhortation to stay calm was unnecessary. Miss Betterton received the news without a flicker of either surprise or distress. She turned to Dalgliesh.
"So you did need a sniffer dog, after all. A pity you didn't think to bring one. Where was he murdered? I speak of the Archdeacon."
"In the church, Miss Betterton."
"Father Sebastian won't like that. Hadn't you better tell him?"
Her brother said, "He has been told, Agatha. Everyone has."
"Well, he won't be missed. Not in this house. He was an extremely unpleasant man, Commander. I refer to the Archdeacon, of course. I could explain to you why I take this view, but these are confidential, family matters. You will understand, I'm sure. You look an intelligent and discreet officer. I expect that comes with being ex-Navy. Some people are better dead. I won't explain why the Archdeacon is among them, but you can be assured that the world will be a more agreeable place without him. but you will have to do something about the body. It can't stay in the church. Father Sebastian wouldn't like that at all. What about the services? Won't it be in the way? I shan't attend, of course. I'm not a religious woman, but my brother does, and I don't think he would like to walk over the archdeacon's body. Whatever our private opinions of the man, that would not be agreeable. Dalgleish said, "The body will be moved, Miss Betterton, but the church will have to remain closed at least for a few days. I have some questions I need to ask you. Did either you or your brother leave your apartment here at any time after Compline yesterday?" "And why should we wish to do that, Commander?" "That's why I'm asking you, Miss Betterton. Did either of you leave the apartment after 10 last night?" He looked from one to the other. Father John said, 11 o'clock is our bedtime. I didn't leave the flat after Compline or later, and I'm sure Agatha didn't. Why should she?" "Would either of you have heard if the other had left?" It was Miss Betterton who replied, "Of course not. We don't lie awake wondering what the other is doing. My brother is perfectly at liberty to wander about the house at night if he wishes, but I can't see why he should. I expect you're wondering, Commander, whether either of us killed the Archdeacon. I'm not a fool. I know where all this is leading. Well, I didn't, and I don't suppose my brother did. He is not a man of action." Father John, visibly distressed, was vehement. "Of course I didn't, Agatha. How can you think that?" "I wasn't thinking it. The Commander was." She turned to Dalgleish. "The Archdeacon was going to turn us out. He told me. Out of this flat." Father John said, "He couldn't do that, Agatha. You must have misunderstood him." Dalgleish asked, "When did this happen, Miss Betterton?" "The last time the Archdeacon was here. It was a Monday morning. I went to the piggery to see if Surtees had any vegetables he could let me have. He's really very helpful when one runs out. I was just walking away when I met the Archdeacon. I expect he was coming to get some free vegetables too, or perhaps he wanted to see the pigs. I recognized him at once. Of course I didn't expect to see him, and I may have been a little sharp in my greeting. I'm not a hypocrite. I don't believe in pretending to like people. As I'm not religious, I don't have to exercise Christian charity, and no one told me he was visiting the college. Why can't I be told these things? I wouldn't have known he was here now if Raphael Abathanot hadn't told me." She turned to Dalgleish. "I expect you've met Raphael Abathanot. He's a delightful boy and very clever. He has supper with us occasionally and we'll read a play together. He could have been an actor if the priests hadn't got a hold of him. He can take any part and mimic every voice. It's a remarkable skill." Father John said, "My sister is fond of the theatre. She and Raphael go up to London once a term for a morning shopping, lunch, and a matinee." Miss Betterton said, "I think it means a lot to him, getting out of this place. But I'm afraid I don't hear as well as I used to. Actors today aren't trained to project their voices. Mumble, mumble, mumble. Do you think they have classes in mumbling at drama school and sit in a circle mumbling at each other? Even if we sit in the front of the stalls, it's sometimes quite difficult. Of course, I don't complain to Raphael. I wouldn't wish to hurt his feelings." Dalgleish said gently, "But what exactly did the Archdeacon say to you when you thought he was threatening to have you evicted from your apartment?" "It was something about people being too ready to live off church funds and give little or nothing in return." Father John broke in. "He wouldn't have said that, Agatha. Are you sure you're remembering correctly?" "He may not have used those precise words, John, but that's what he meant. And then he said that I shouldn't take it for granted that I could stay here for the rest of my life. I understood him perfectly well. He was threatening to get us out." Father John, distressed, said, "But he couldn't, Agatha. He hadn't the power."
That's what Raphael said when I told him about it. We were talking about it the last time he was here for supper. I said to Raphael, if he could get my brother put in prison, he can do anything. Raphael said, oh, no, he can't. I'll stop him.
Father John, in despair at the way the interview was going, had moved over to the window. He said, there's a motorcycle coming along the coast road.
How very odd.
I don't think we're expecting anyone this morning.
Perhaps it's a visitor for you, Commander.
Dalgleish moved beside him. He said, I shall have to leave you now, Miss Betterton. Thank you for your cooperation. I may have some other questions, and if so, I will ask what time would be convenient for you to see me. And now, Father, could I please see your bunch of keys?
Father John disappeared and returned almost immediately, holding his key ring.
Dalgleish compared the two church keys with the ones on Father Martin's ring. He said, where did you leave these keys last night, Father?
In the usual place, on my bedside table. I always put the keys there at night.
As he left, leaving Father John with his sister, he glanced at the golf clubs. The heads were uncovered, the metal of the iron shone clean. The mental picture was uncomfortably clear and convincing. It would need someone with a good eye, and there would be the difficulty of concealing the club until the moment had come to strike, the moment when the Archdeacon's attention was fixed on the vandalized doom. But was that a problem? It could have been propped against the rear of a pillar, and with a weapon of that length, there would be much less risk of bloodstains. He had a sudden and vivid picture of a fair-haired young man waiting motionless in the shadows, club in hand. The Archdeacon would not have left his bed and gone to the church if summoned by Raphael, but here was a young man who, on Miss Betterton's evidence, could mimic anyone's voice.
7. Dr. Mark Ayling's arrival was as surprising as it was unexpectedly early. Dalgleish was moving down the stairs from the Betterton's flat when he heard the motorcycle roaring into the courtyard. Pilbeam had unlocked the great door as he did each morning, and Dalgleish stepped out into the half-light of a fresh-smelling day, which, after the tumult of the night, held an exhausted calm.